Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I do want to get into the interview with the great Liam Stowell, but I did want to add this preface on the start of today's show that because of Liam's profession as a mental health nurse, we do talk a lot about mental health and mental illness. If you do struggle with mental illness, then I want you to know that you are not alone. I want you to know that there's loads of people that you can speak to, even though sometimes it doesn't feel like you can. I'm going to put everyone below in the show notes, all the major people that you should speak to, all the people that you can speak to, or all the necessary resources that you need. You know, I don't have too much experience myself. I know of things and I know of people, but I do want you to know that from experiences that a lot of people listening to this have had, that a lot of people have shared, it's so tricky. It's such a tricky situation to be in. It's such a tricky debate. And what we need to do as a society is learn how to deal with these things in a constructive way, and in a way that really requires getting beyond this broken system. So yeah, I wanted you to know that you're not alone. There's loads of resources around, and you know, if you're ever feeling down, well, we as socialists and we as a movement and we as a class and we as a people must get through this together. And the problem shared is a problem halved, and a victory for one is a victory for all. So yeah, let's advance. And I really hope you know, with that discussion at the start, that we do talk about some heavy themes in this show, that you do enjoy my episode with Liam Stowell, because it's one of the best in a while. So enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Lefty, your half-witty podcast on which we discuss politics and news, all from a left perspective. This week I'm talking to Liam Stowell, who's an NHS worker, a mental health worker, working at Merseycare, and I'll let Liam introduce himself. So Liam, what's your background and how did that lead you to socialism?
Hi, you know, thanks for having me on, and you know, I'm impressed that you've pronounce my surname correctly, because most people get that wrong, so that's definitely a good start. Yeah, so like you say, I'm a mental health nurse. I've been a mental health nurse now, I think it's 8 years if I think about it. I've worked in the NHS for 13 years now, so it's been a while. I'm working in mental health, so I currently work in a mental health crisis team for young people. And to be honest, my journey into socialism, it's probably come out at a very early age. I mean, family, a very sort of left wing in terms of their politics. So it's always been something that's on my radar. And I think the more I've delved into the world of mental health, it's really opened my eyes to some real serious social problems which significantly impact upon people's mental health, and I can't sort of overstate that as much, to be honest. Like, I think unless you've almost see it firsthand, and you don't really have to go far, like you don't necessarily have to be a professional to almost see the poverty and devastation around you. You know, you only have to go, whether it's on your doorstep or to the estate over, or you know, a few streets down, it's there for everyone to see. You know, with, you know, it's not even recently in terms of rising prices in terms of bills and things like that. You know, that's putting pressure on. It's been, you know, it's been around for as long as anything. But you know, in terms of what I've seen, it's without a doubt getting worse, or people's resilience to it seems to be getting less, and that's causing significant sort of mental health problems.
We'll come on to mental health and young people in a sec, but before that I did just want to say that I've seen, not personally of course, but through others that I know, have seen a lot of issues surrounding mental health with other people. And of course, just experiences that a lot of people have, I feel like it's great to have someone like you on, Liam, who is willing to talk about these things and is willing to give an alternative viewpoint to the one we hear in the media.
Yeah, and I think the media have sort of I've got wind of things, especially the mental health issues, but I think they've they tend to sort of miss the mark a bit like that. So although I do celebrate more sort of media coverage of people's difficulties, especially as things are rising, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, really, because sometimes sometimes if you just convey the almost after effects of things, it almost perpetuates it, because it puts in people's sort of consciousness if that's the way to deal with things. And so, like I say, it's a bit of a double-edged sword in terms of, say, sometimes the more you report an issue such as self-harm, sometimes the more times people self-harm. And if you just report the issue, you're not sort of dealing with the underlying cause. And obviously, that is multifactorial, and there's lots of issues to do with it. And I think that's where mainstream media does miss the mark, in terms of, if you're just talking about the prevalence, you're missing the issues in terms of whether that's poverty, trauma, abuse, you know, difficulties in terms of your sexuality, your identity. I mean, like I say, that the list I could go on and on with it. And I think that's the thing that's missing in terms of the narrative around mental health from the media.
Yeah, you don't hear as much about a lot of these things, and when it is presented in the media, you typically find that it's from perspective that they just expect is given. Like, not everyone has access to good quality services and these things, and especially with the underfunding of like the National Health Service and their team and all that. It's not like the if NHS services that are supposed to deal with a lot of young people are underfunded, then it's very tricky for them to get this sort of care.
Yeah, no, definitely, and I think, you know, in terms of the funding as well. So I think, say, CAMHS is obviously what I work in. In terms of the overall budget, gets less than 1% of it. And, you know, you don't have to go far in terms of finding stories of, you know, huge waiting lists or, you know, significant increase in young people's mental health difficulties and mental health difficulties overall. And there is a funding issue, but there's also an issue in terms of how those funds get spent. And, you know, I'm sure it's something we'll get onto in terms of the NHS overall. But like I say, specifically in terms of mental health, it's sometimes the focus is almost on the illness side of it. And that's only one small factor. Like I said, in terms of how people get to this stage where, whether you want to call it a mental health crisis or a breakdown, whatever terminology, you know, fits that individual in terms of how they are perceiving that situation, it is not discussed. And that's why we're getting more, you know, the last 2 years have put a real microscope, I think, on society's deficits in terms of the pandemic. And although it's, I think, probably sadly going to be used as a bit of an excuse at times, it's been helpful in terms of, I think, lots of people can see where the issues are, but it's also a hindrance in terms of how we get those resolved, because inevitably, especially in the NHS, a lot of money has been given in terms of trying to combat the COVID-19 pandemic. I don't think what's definitely not discussed in the media, or I've not seen, is how it's going to be paid back. You can't imagine this government or any of the two sort of, well, mainstream parties, they don't just give these things for free out of the goodness of their own heart, do they? There's always a debt to it, and inevitably the NHS, there'll be further cuts in terms of its services, and we're already seeing that. And we've seen that last 10 years in terms of acute beds, and I'm not talking about mental health beds here, I'm talking about acute medical beds. You know, there's been a significant decrease in them. I think the figure is over 10,000. I'm not too sure the exact number, but I know it's over 10,000. And that's part of the issue of what we're seeing in terms of trying to manage these health crises. It's historically, we would have been in a much better position, but as we've got huge staffing problems. And it's the same in mental health. We've had a 25% reduction in inpatient beds as well over the last 10 years. So when now people are in these crises, it's difficult. and I've spoke about this before, but I think in a way, in terms of the mental health bed shortage, it was, I like to think it was done in a good way in terms of trying to keep people in the community. Unfortunately, if you don't fund the community services properly and don't fund communities properly in terms of having a adequate social care structure set up, you're going to be left, you know, in this situation where hospital beds are flooded. And I'm not using that term dramatically. This is very much true. If anyone wants to go to their local A&E department, I don't necessarily advise it for a pleasant trip out, but you will just see corridors upon corridors of people who possibly don't even need to be in A&E, but they've got nowhere else to go. So they're there, and unfortunately we don't have any placements for people to go to, and inevitably that ends up being, especially the elderly population. So you've got people just on very small beds getting, sadly, very little care because, you know, these departments are very much overstretched. And we don't really want to talk about it, or it doesn't want to be discussed in a way that it wants to resolve. There seems to be just an acceptance that people of a certain age are being left to die. And once again, that's not being dramatic. That's been the case. And you know, there's been plenty of things over the pandemic when lots and lots of stories of old people being just sent back to care homes, essentially to die because we can't care for them anymore.
Yeah, it's incredibly sad, and it's incredibly emotionally, it really brings out emotions of a lot of people, the actions of the government. It's been an incredibly emotional time. And you know, the government's treatment towards the elderly, especially, it's just been awful, because we used to have this philosophy in Britain that because they cared for us when they were younger, we should care for them now they're older. But for some reason, we've lost that, and the government doesn't want to embrace that. And we feel as if that it's just acceptable to throw out the elderly just because they're old. And the care home debacle in the UK and in Scotland to some degree too, it's been a complete travesty. I don't really want to like go to too many experiences of some of the things that you've seen, but if you could just give a brief sort of introduction to some of the problems plaguing young people, especially in the UK, you know, it doesn't need to be too personal or anything.
Yeah, sure, not a problem. So I suppose there's some like anecdotal type things, but nationally, most sort of young people's crisis mental health services have seen an increase of referrals of around sort of 100-200%, which is obviously huge numbers. Eating disorder services are even higher. We're talking about 400% an increase in referral rates. So, you know, these are huge numbers over a very, very short space of time. And, you know, there's reasons behind that, which is beyond some control as well. But at the same time, there are reasons where it was already increasing once again before the pandemic. And I think if we just use that as an excuse, I think we get lost in that, because we were seeing these things, you know, 2+ years ago anyway. But the risks that young people are now taking when they're feeling, whether it's suicidal or they feel there is no other option, are, once again, they seem much greater or much more frequent or severe than they did even probably 5 years ago. An increase in children going into the care system over the past sort of 5 years as well, a significant increase, which once again, I think that should highlight a bit of the failings in society of children going into the care system. But unfortunately, in the care system, the majority of providers are from the private sector, and what lots of these companies do will buy up cheap housing, staff it with, unfortunately, very underskilled, undervalued and underpaid people, which understandably they're not equipped to manage some of the most traumatized and complex young people in our society. what tends to happen is the placements break down very, very quickly, and children get moved all around the country, so far from where they know, far from family and friends. And even though sometimes family and friends can be rather abusive, it's still what they know, it's still a familiarity of which is being taken from them. And this causes significant problems in terms of just being moved around as a child. And once again, I'm not using this term in any dramatic sense, but it's child trafficking. You know, I think there's a snobbishness probably from the media and with many people in this country, probably because they're unaware. We think that, you know, some developing country, probably in Asia or Africa, that does these type of things, but it's happening on our doorstep, you know, and it's completely sanctioned by councils and governments, and these companies charge extortionate amounts of money to look after these children purely for profit. And you have to question that, don't you? When any company is making profit off a young person's trauma, then it just seems unimaginable. It seems unconscionable in terms of how you'd almost sleep at night with that. And I'm not saying every company's like that. Of course, I'm not. I don't use, you know, to be that inflammatory. But at the same time, I've seen lots and lots of poor things over my time in mental health.
Thanks for that, Liam. It means a lot. I wanted to touch briefly on a different subject that I'm quite passionate about, but I don't think gets covered a lot in the media. I wanted to talk about men and men's mental health in particular, because you see a lot I'm mostly meaning young men, maybe between the ages of 15, 16 to the age of somewhere around 40. Young men who have poor mental health and the way they suffer. And I just wanted to touch on your thoughts around this question, because I don't think there's enough discussion of it in the media or in the public or in the public sphere of debate.
Yeah, I agree, and it's something I'm similarly passionate about and have been for a long time. In particular, young men who end up in the criminal justice system as well. For me, I think when it gets discussed, once again, it gets discussed almost at the extreme end of things. So as we know, the highest reason for young men dying around that age group is suicide. But once again, it's never discussed then why. And, you know, there's lots of reasons for that. But one of the reasons, if you look into when young men, when they are younger, in terms of how they convey their emotions or distress or however you want to term it, it tends to be quite externalist. So there'll be sometimes aggressive type behaviours, and they will often be then labelled as maybe naughty or problematic children. But it's the same as whether it be, you know, another young person, and if they're cutting or they're feeling anxious or depressed, it comes from a very similar place in terms of this aggression. It's often from a place of anxiety or uncertainty. And I know it sounds very simplistic, but hurt people hurt people. Like, it's, you know, a young person doing these things, like in school, for example, if a young person is struggling in whether it be English or maths, and they're being disruptive or angry and aggressive, it's probably because they don't understand that lesson. It's rare that it's just because they're messing around, because that doesn't tend to exist. We have to find the reason behind this. And I think that's what gets lost. And I think especially young men. So they will get excluded. And this starts a chain of events then. Because if you get excluded from education, it's that rejection. So it starts a thing of not being able to trust adults, and you're almost acting in a similarly aggressive way to them. And, you know, that's not an ideal circumstance at all. You know, it's no coincidence that the majority of school exclusions are young men. And then we have a very much a gender disparity in terms of youth justice services and mental health services. So young people in CAM services, Normally, it tends to be around 80-85% young women and 15% young men. It's changing slightly, but then youth justice services tend to be around 90% young males, 10% young females. So there's a huge disparity between the two. But you know, these young people are experiencing the same things. They're from the same areas. They're from the same families. But one tends to go down that criminal route, yet the other tends to go down a mental health route. And I think that's maybe why we get different things in terms of suicides as well. I think that's one of the reasons, because the support's drastically different, because one person's getting support, the other person's getting criminalized. And I don't think that's good. And I think we need to start understanding why young men, you know, get treated in this way or get criminalized in this way. And we need to understand it from a very much a trauma-informed way and be compassionate about it, rather than ostracizing them in society and wonder why we get high levels of suicide and our high levels of violence and high levels of people continuing the criminal justice system. It's just not acceptable. And, you know, despite the best will in the world, I think we still have very much quite strong gender stereotypes when it comes to emotion. You know, the phrases of man up or and things like that are still, you know, very common. And part of it is, you know, some of the stereotypes are somewhat true, because the more you sort of reinforce them in society, they become true, even though not, if that makes sense. So young men will almost be aggressive because they're told they are aggressive. So it becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think some of these things need to change. And I think, unfortunately, most services are set up to do very much brief intervention type work. And it's very much that one-to-one talking. Also, young men can often struggle with that. It's a real intensity to being able to sit in front of someone, as whether you're 14, 15, or even into your early 20s, that you've never met before, and engage them on that very intimate personal level about your emotions, especially if you don't really understand them. And emotions themselves are, they're very abstract. You tend to show emotions rather than talk about them. So to get into a different frame of mind where you can discuss your feelings can take a long time and a lot of role modeling from a really good practitioner. Unfortunately, most services don't tend to have the time to be able to do that. And I think that's where also young men get failed. And I think the difference is some young females and young women, because our society raises them very much different, they're able to communicate their emotions in different ways. So I think services need to change to meet the needs of young men, rather than just that sitting down talking to people. And we need to think of more pragmatic, practical ways. Like there's something like I used to do, that I managed to get an Xbox into the clinic I used to work in, because then I would just play computer games with young men, but then talk to them whilst they were distracted, because that's their world, isn't it? It's around compute, about gaming, or whether it's football or whatnot. So I had to be part of a bit of their world for them to get to trust me. And I think that's how things need to change, because otherwise we're never going to move on from this situation.
I think that's a completely great statement, Liam, that I know a lot of young men listening to this will empathise with. You raised one point there which I found very interesting. You know, you talked about language surrounding men being strong and, you know, like man up and all that, and how men are told from a very early age that they have to fulfil this role. Do you think, I've heard a lot of people, people like Martin Daubney and that, talk about this concept of positive masculinity, where men can be strong and fulfill this role, but they can find comfort in other forms of masculinity. But then, of course, there's an argument from some feminist comrades that that all masculinity is toxic and oppressive, and it usually does lead to this sort of these struggles. Is there a place that you stand in that debate?
I think it's interesting, because I think it's very cultural as well. And I think mental health is a very westernized concept in terms of how we understand mental health, and how services set up tends to meet the needs of very much Anglo-white westernized people, because that's where, you know, the thing that we use in terms of mental illness, the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, was formed in America, and in a very affluent part of America. So their understanding, as you can imagine, it was very cultural, it was very of the time, and it sort of expanded upon that, but it's still got very much a Western slant. So I think sometimes when we have these debates, it's about our culture, and then they don't necessarily fit all the others as well, because inevitably, you know, however you identify, and masculinity is going to be different. You know, it's different locally, isn't it? You know, I'm from Manchester, but masculinity for someone maybe from Surrey, it's different. And I think sometimes we can get lost in the very sort of abstract idea of it, or we try to oversimplify it as well. And I think sometimes that can stop debates over it. And I think that's where I struggle, because it's such a complex thing, not just the human brain, but human emotion. You know, when we understand one another from a cultural and socioeconomic and political point of view, you know, there's so many things into it. For me, I like to just almost see an individual, and not necessarily from a neoliberal ideology, but how that individual fits within that society, rather than an overarching idea of masculinity. But I know this might seem like I'm doing a bit of a cop-out, but but I'm not. You have to still have these things in mind, and I think that's almost the beauty and art of working in the field that I do. You almost need to understand every aspect of this, because it depends on that person and how they understand themselves as well. Because if they are a feminist, or if someone is a Marxist or whatever, that's still a factor into their personality and then into their mental health as well. So it's really interesting to have these things. And I suppose I don't really sit anywhere. I'm more of someone who wants to understand all of it and how that fits in with an individual that I'm faced with. If that makes sense.
Well, oh no, it's completely fair. It is grounded in personality and these things. I don't think it's a cop out. I think it's a very good way of putting it. There is this problem that we have when we talk about not just masculinity but mental health generally, that we fall into this trap of either getting so bogged down in the psychology of it, or we just say it's this simple, it's X and Y. You know, that's one of the tricky things about coming at this from a socialist perspective, is that everyone's got a different understanding, and everyone's got a different experience of these things. So when we have these debates, it's going to be an individual thing. And I think that's also quite culturally enriching, because everyone brings their own experiences. And, you know, for someone who hasn't experienced mental illness like myself, not to say that I never will, but I haven't, it's very interesting to contrast stories in that, but in a productive way, that we can find something that all people can work towards. I think it's a very culturally enriching thing. I understand we're a bit pressed for time, so I wanted to come on to some questions about the sort of broader state of the National Health Service.
Yeah, of course.
You're a strong campaigner for the NHS Pay 15 campaign, which, for those who aren't aware, is a demand for NHS workers to receive a 15% pay rise. This seems more important to me given the pandemic and all that recently. But why has the government not met this demand?
I think it's... I know I sort of almost just said before, like, not to oversimplify it, but I'm almost going to oversimplify it now. I think it's almost as simple as they've got a very much an agenda to strangle the NHS and to shut it down as quickly as possible. So if they don't pay people, obviously, what I very much believe they deserve, and I think 15% is probably quite a modest increase in comparison to the cuts we've received over many, many years. And So I think that's definitely part of it, because inevitably it becomes a less and less attractive place for people to work. So then what happens then is services are all on, for the most part, reduced staffing, which obviously then impacts upon patient care. And then you can, you know, this ripple effect onto services and the NHS as a whole happens. And no matter how much money you put into our service, if you're not paying people well enough, and, you know, even though I'm not a capitalist, you know, according to what the market says, we also are worth, then you're going to lose people. So inevitably then, you know, the private and independent sector will pay more. So people understandably go there because, you know, there's been no shortage of storage, you know, stories of nurses having to go to food banks or to not be able to pay the bills or just leaving the profession completely. And, you know, over recent years, there's been many, many people retiring, but we haven't really replaced them. Although there has been more of an uptake in terms of people going onto nursing courses. And I think in a very warped way, I think the pandemic has helped that, because I think people actually saw it as a really valued profession and wanted to be part of that. I suppose time will tell whether that transpires to nurses on the ground and doctors and paramedics and OTs, and, you know, I don't necessarily need to go on and on, but all the professions that make the NHS such a wonderful thing. And, you know, I think it's without a doubt a credit to everyone who works in it. Despite this, I'd say for the most part, we provide absolutely unbelievable care to people. And I'd like to say most time when we don't, it's not out of a maliciousness or an incompetence. It's just because services are completely stretched and undervalued, and these unrealistic targets put in, which are just unattainable. And then that has that, once again, that ripple effect. So I think that's without a doubt part of it. And I think, sadly, they're succeeding very well in that agenda.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's sickening. I think in our society, no one should have to use a food bank. However, I think not to have a sort of, you know, a hierarchy in my mind, but the people who should not be using food, like the least, you know, who should be using food bank is nurses and is doctors, and, you know, people who work inside the National Health Service. They, you know, the Tories went on and on during lockdown about clapping for the carers and, you know, saying we love the NHS and all that, and putting NHS like rainbow flags everywhere. And, you know, that's great, but you've also got to show on a policy level and on a social level that you care for the National Health Service. Because NHS workers going to a food bank is, to me, just sickening, given that, you know, everyone knows a nurse, everyone knows a doctor, and it's just completely, you know, not right. On another issue that I wanted to talk about surrounding the NHS, I know that the government and the National Health Service backtracked on this a little bit, and I know that it's quite a charged issue, so I'm not sure if you're going to completely want to get fully into it, but there was the campaign of NHS 100K a while ago, mm-hmm. Of NHS workers who did not take the COVID-19 vaccine, who were sceptical of the vaccine or couldn't have the vaccine and were being sacked or fired or asked to leave their jobs, and it turned out that it was altogether it was about 80,000 people. Did you have a stance on this that you wanted to talk about? I won't give my stance right now. I'd like to see what yours is first.
Yeah, no, I'm more than happy to talk about that. I think it's part of a bigger picture which has been created probably over the past probably 5 to 10 years of forcing people into very divisive opinions about very, very complex problems. And I think it forced people to almost this oversimplification. So I think Brexit was one of these things, and then sort of COVID and you know, there's been a number of examples over recent years of which you almost, people are falling into one camp or another. And to me, that just doesn't make sense. Like, and once people have almost picked an opinion, like, they could never ever change that, you know, just even if other evidence came out or other things. And it's a very difficult thing to understand in terms of, if you are not a scientist and this was a very new sort of virus and disease, and there's so much information out there, so to make a real informed judgment either way is pretty much impossible. So I think what got lost in the debate was around this very emotive thing of saving lives. And I think what got lost with it was almost the suddenness of the pressure that NHS staff got put on in terms of choosing their livelihood over something that most people were a bit uncertain about. And even people that were, you know, were certain on it for whatever reason, because they're told to, like, it's still a relatively new thing. So I can understand people's anxieties around it. I will happily, you know, tell people that I had my vaccine because part of me, I suppose, wants to trust the scientific community, even though I probably had similar reservations to people who didn't as well. And I want to support people making that choice, because I think we get into real dodgy grounds when we're enforcing medical interventions on people to be part of a job. So I think that's probably my stance.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was very opposed to the NHS mandate, despite the fact that I'm, you know, double vaxxed. I thought that the NHS mandate was wrong, and, you know, like, I've got some stories here, like a paramedic with 6 years service, a scientist with 13 years service, a physiotherapist with 31 years service, paramedics with 9 years service, mental health workers with 21 years service, all of this to the NHS, and I felt it was very wrong for the government and for those higher up in the health service to sort of write them off.
And just one more thing on that as well. I think everyone I knew that was sceptical about it were more than willing to do other positions within the NHS until more information came out. So, do you know what I mean? Like, there wasn't this sort of, I think how it was conveyed of almost this tinfoil hat, people thinking, oh my God, I'm going to immediately fall down and die if I have it. It was about more than that. And I think that's, once again, inevitably gets lost on things like social media, because they need to have it in a very small segment, don't they? But I think once you engage with people, I think that's a bigger problem, I think, in society as well. We're almost forced into just snippets, and once again, it's oversimplification. So, you know, it needs to be so many characters long to understand such a point, and then that becomes everything about your point. Like, that just doesn't make sense, does it? Like, there's more to it than that.
Yeah, I completely agree. Now, I know we are a bit pressed for time, and we're probably going to go over a little bit. But I was wondering, it's not so, I know it does have mental health impacts, but it's not so much of a mental health debate generally, but I know it's got strong mental health impacts about this week's leaked documents from the United States over the abortion at the Supreme Court. I was just wondering if you could give me your view, and I know you're not working in the United States, so you can't really give too much of an experienced view on the US, but just from the UK, do you know how much this is going to impact people's mental health across the pond?
I think, as often happens, and especially in the United States, it's very much this wanting to control women, isn't it, and women's bodies. And there seems a very unhealthy obsession about this. And, you know, the US is very disparaging about certain Asian and especially Islamic countries because they're ruled by a law that they've decided in their own head. But the US is essentially a theocracy, isn't it, in terms of how it's governed?
So true, so true.
And, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of people in higher who are very much aware of this and use this very much their own advantage. But even though it seems a bit Stone Age to us in the UK, I don't think we're too much better, especially in terms of our treatment of women and this sort of, like I said, once again, it's wanting to control, you know, if we think of both countries, you know, domestic violence is significantly on the rise, sexual assaults on the rise, rapes on the rise. And, you know, these horrifying statistics in terms of it from both countries, rapes is, if not the, it's one of the easiest crimes to get away with. It's something like a 99% chance you can get away with it, which is just horrifying, isn't it?
And
most of sexual assault is, you know, male towards female as well. And I think that's part of it. So it's going to significantly impact upon women's mental health, because if you are feeling out of control for whatever reason, or you're not able to look after, and it's not a child, do you know what I mean, at this period of time, and it's nothing to do with anyone else. It's almost, once again, these private personal decisions. There seems to, once again, this obsession of wanting to make people's private, personal, sexual life public, but then they're a bit horrified of talking about it at the same time. There's this very sort of warped thing that we have, and I think in both countries, if we have, like I say, this a bit of an obsession around women's sex life and what they should and shouldn't be doing with it. And most of the time, it's from men being very discriminatory about them. And I always feel a bit strange talking about that, because obviously, you know, I'm a man and identify as such. So when I'm always asked to speak about what's seen as a very much predominantly women's issue, I always think, God, I have no authority over this whatsoever, and I probably shouldn't be giving an opinion.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes when people say that, I know that they're coming from a good place, but I I'm a bit of a free speech absolutist. I think people should be allowed to say whatever the hell they want about anything. And I don't think anyone should be told off for it. I don't talk about it that much, but I'm very pro-choice. I'm very pro a woman's right to choose, and I think it'd have terrible effects on society if we started banning that. I think it'd set a terrible precedent for the United States. And, you know, when the state starts making moral decisions, that's when the state is moving away from liberalism. And, you know, I'm an illiberal. I'm not a liberal at all, but I'm a socialist. When the state starts making moral decisions, especially under capitalism, then you're moving towards fascism, and that's the opposite direction to where I want to go. I think it's very dangerous. And I think that if these documents are true, which I have no reason to believe that they're not, it sets a very dangerous precedent for women. And I think a lot of women are very scared, rightfully very scared by this. And it's important that we stand back and we fight. We step forward and we fight. Just lastly, Liam, because I know I've used up a lot of time, I was just wondering, what's your message, just lastly today, for all of those fighting for a better world?
I think it's not to give up hope, is it? And I think, in particular, I think for people who are struggling with the mental health and things as well, or the feeling alone, I think it's about connecting, and I think we need to get back to a society, and whatever that means for you. And it's just about whether that's an online connection or whether that's an in-person connection. I think often when we're sort of down on our knees, and it feels like many more people are at the moment, lots of good comes from it. And I think that shows there's an appetite within society. at almost most levels where people, they genuinely do want to support one another. They don't want to see people suffering. And I think that's what we should all cling to, because the majority of us are only, you know, one or two paychecks away from being on that poverty line. So, you know, let's fight this together, because it's achievable. Many other countries are doing it and have done it. So there's no reason why we in the UK can't do the same.
Liam Stahl, thank you very much for coming on to The Leftist today.
Thank you.